First, quickly, general idea that we went over last time, that this picture that is true in any deterministic hidden variables theory, that quantum theory, there is an analogy between quantum theory and this sort of classical thermodynamic heat death of the universe. If the whole universe was in a state of global thermal equilibrium with all systems at the same temperature, then you have probabilities given by this universal Boltzmann factor, there would be the universal thermal noise. It would not be possible to convert heat into work, but that would not be a law of physics, it would be a contingency of the state. And the statistics of fluctuations could be encoded in this simple function, the partition function. Regardless of how as I pointed out last time, the gas in thermal equilibrium, it doesn't matter how it got there. You just need some parameters, volume, temperature, and so on, to give you the statistics of fluctuation. Yeah.
So I have two questions. First of all, what do you mean by volume noise? And second of all,
what do I mean?
Yeah.
Well, I mean the fact that there is, in quantum theory, if you perform an experiment, a particular setup, then from one run of the experiment to another, there is, you don't get the same outcome all the time. There is a statistical distribution, so actually, which is given by the Bohm rule. That's all I mean. So quantum noise is just the probability distributions of quantum theory. So analogous to thermal noise, and we have this thing that we discussed, that non-locality cannot be converted into signals, and the statistics can all be encoded in the density of it. Sorry,
yeah, in the heat death universe, so would it be always impossible to convert heat to work or statistically on the long run to be possible to convert positive?
So it is really I think I mentioned this last time. Strictly speaking, if I had an infinite universe in thermal equilibrium, with probability one, there are going to be large regions that are actually away from equilibrium, just for statistical fluctuation. And so there's a sense in which, you know, it could be that the ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, could start boiling tomorrow. If it did, clearly we could use it to do work. But, you know, so that kind, if you're talking about very rare fluctuations, then there's a sense in which, I mean, here it becomes tricky even to say, what do you mean by equilibrium? It's sort of tricky. So you get similar things here. I mean, from the hidden variable point of view, in an infinite universe, there are going to be regions where the hidden variables happen to have anomalous distribution. And you measure the spin of another spin z, you measure it along x, and you always get plus x. Could happen. But as Joe pointed out, you know, just quantum theory itself, being a statistical theory, will predict such flukes anyway. Quantum theory will predict that, you know, this kind of thing will happen. So leaving aside the issues of rare fluctuation. So anyway, and the idea is that this, so as in the classical case, from the hidden variables point of view, this is a sort of contingency, it's a state that we have to be in. It's not a state that is dictated by fundamental laws. So the properties of this state, such as locality, are not really fundamental. And the idea is that a sort of hidden variables analog of this heat death has actually taken place in our universe. So also, last time,
can it fairly see that analogy by saying that we haven't yet reached the heat death, but the quantum potential creates the extra amount of kind of mixing complexity that means that the quantum mechanics has already largely met its.
Right. So it's not quite that. What it is, so the question you're asking is, well, why is it we're not in thermal equilibrium?
For the quantum case. I mean, yeah.
In classically, why is it we're not in thermal equilibrium? And now the answer that most people give, it's a bit controversial, but most cosmologists do this. But in the very early universe, there is thermal equilibrium. Okay. And what happens as the universe expands, gravity has this peculiarity of amplifying small temperature gradients. So in the very early universe, you have a unit, you know, at least within a causal horizon, it is believed to be in thermal equilibrium. And there are these small fluctuations in energy density, which get, they grow by gravitational condensation and eventually form, you know, large-scale structure, galaxies, stars, and of course so these temperature gradients are now, you know, the center of the sun, we're in hundreds of millions of degrees, and here it's 20 degrees. So that is, it's a peculiarity of gravity. If it wasn't for gravity, we would be living in a classical thermal equilibrium. Now, then this then raises the question, well, could there be some analogous phenomenon here? And I'm actually going to talk about this possibility that maybe gravity can somehow offset this state. If we leave out gravity, then you're just stuck in this state. So I thought I should, you don't worry about time, it started late. So last time at the end I showed you how if you had, in pilot wave theory, if you had a non-standard distribution of particles, you could make sub-quantum measurements on ordinary systems. The discussion was a bit rough, so I thought maybe I'd go over it again. Would people be interested in seeing that?
You want to think experimentally in the class also because we started late.
Okay, so let me do this. I'm going to quickly go over what. I was showing you how you can measure the position of a particle without disturbing its wave function. What I'm going to do is take a simpler example of a wave function that is a superposition of just two very narrow thing, almost dot function, you know, very peak. So this is a single particle. So the sun position x. So this is our system. It has a coordinate x. And it has this wave function that psi 1, I can't remember. Psi 1 plus psi 2. Okay. And you want to see, you know, usually if I measure the position of this particle, I'm going to find it in here or in here, and at the end there's an effective collapse of the wave function. Okay, even in the Broglie theory, if I find it in here, the wave function will effectively collapse. Now, the idea is, what we're going to do, we're going to do the usual coupling to a pointer. There's some pointer coordinate y. Okay, let's call this y. And there's an initial packet for the pointer, well, just some narrow Gaussian, if you like. This is the initial wave function of the packet. And it has a width, let's call it delta 0. Okay? So this is all just ordinary quantum theory for the moment. We're going to switch on this coupling. And you know that the initial wave function, the total wave function evolved with that coupling. This is a sort of a standard von Neumann position measurement. Okay, the coupling is designed to bring about this correlation between the pointer position and the position of the particles. Okay, so this pointer, this packet, is sort of it either moves this way. Well, there are two branches: one where it moves this way, one where it moves that way. Okay. Now, if you look at let's look at the joint probability distribution for x and y. So in equilibrium, so far this is ordinary quantum theory, the joint probability distribution, remembering these two packets, psi 1 and psi 2, don't overlap, so there's no cross term here. Okay, this is the joint probability distribution. Now let me draw this. So let me draw you this. The shaded region is the region where probability is non-zero. Okay, this is the support. At the initial time. And this distance here is just the width of the pointer packet. Okay, x is either x1 or x2, and there's a range, the pointer packet has some width. As this evolves, what you get, well, so these pointer packets move. So what that means is the support, these packets, just this one moves this way, this one moves that way, they just shift in this simple model. Okay. So what happens? So this moves down by an amount a x1 t. This is moved up by an amount a x2 t. So what happens? Let's say now I measure the position. I just do an ordinary measurement of the position of the point. I look at the point, however you want to think about that. It doesn't matter. I measure. Let's say I get some result y measured. Okay. I get some result. This is the result. Well, the total configuration has to be in the support where the probability is non-zero. So you can deduce, x is in here for value x2. Okay. Of course, if the measurement was found in here, then you wouldn't know whether it's here or here. Once the packets have separated, okay, once the packets have separated, after time, okay, once these packets have separated, there's a definite measure. Okay, so the packet is just getting these two branches, the packets separate. Once they've separated, there's a definite quantum measurement that's taken place, and of course, the effective wave function will just be one or other of these packets. Okay, you collapse the wave function. So now, what if instead I start out with a probability distribution? I'm going to do exactly the same thing, except it's the Breuer-Bohm theory with an initial distribution that is equilibrium x, if the system I'm measuring is an ordinary system, times a distribution phi zero of y, which is just narrower. It's just going to be narrower here. Some with double. This is phi zero. Okay, maybe no, I have to put in the square. It's just narrower. Okay? Now, from what I showed you, from the Breuer-Bohm dynamics, it is simple that this is an exactly solvable model. I won't go through the equations for x and y again. But all that happens is that the probability distribution becomes, so let me just do this to save writing out everything again. That this becomes now the probability, the non-equilibrium probability, this thing gets replaced by pi zero. This gets replaced by pi zero, which means you have the same thing again, except this is much narrower. Okay. So these things are just narrower. Okay, well the whole thing, it's just delta zero, the width of the packet becomes W, which is small. Okay. So we're starting out like this, where this is now W. Okay, we're starting out with a narrow packet. So what happens? The things separate in a much shorter time. Okay? All you need is a time W over 2AX, where X, if I take X is equal to mod X, assume X1 and X2 are the same. These distances from the origin are the same, okay? After this time, which is can be very short, if W is arbitrarily small, this time is arbitrarily small, these things just immediately separate. So now at a very short time, if I find that y measure is in here, hey, I can immediately deduce that it's definitely, x is definitely here and not over here, because the packets have already separated. Okay? And, you know, if W is sufficiently small, okay, can be arbitrarily small here, that means that the time evolution of this total packet, I mean, if you look at this, you'll see that if time is much smaller than the width of the wave function over AX, then the total wave function has hardly changed. It's going to be essentially this. Okay? This is the evolution of the wave function is negligible. Okay, so for a sufficiently small W, we've got a situation where the total wave function is still essentially a product. And yet, because the probability distribution to the pointer was so narrow, I can already tell where the particle is. Okay? So that's the idea. So you see here what is happening more and more just in simple terms. All this is saying is, look, here's a system with some, you know, statistical spread. I have my pointer. If the statistical spread of my pointer is the quantum spread, then, you know, when I try to measure the position of that particle, I inevitably, the time it takes to do it, or the amount of interaction that is needed disturbs the wave function. Whereas if the noise in my apparatus is sufficiently small, I can make the measurement without disturbing the wave function. So again, it's sort of this idea of, you know, like this analogy again with the thermal equilibrium. If all systems are at the same temperature, then you're sort of stuck. You can't do what you'd like to do. Whereas if you have systems with less statistical noise than quantum, then you can do unusual things. Okay, so let's see. So I showed you last time how for a non-standard distribution of hidden variables, in the Bohm theory, you get instantaneous signaling. I just wanted to sketch how that happens. I'm wondering if I should bother with this. How that happens in any deterministic hidden variables theory. Okay, so let's go back to the, here I have the usual EPR setup, where I have a singlet state. I have two spin half particles in the singlet state, and I can do measurements at each wing along any axis I choose. And at each wing, there are going to be outcomes, plus or minus one. And we know that in the singlet state, there is a correlation between these outcomes, given by this. Now, a hidden variables theory says that given the experimental conditions, okay, given the conditions of the settings of the apparatus, plus given some unknown initial parameters lambda, there should be a mapping, well, this is a if it's a deterministic theory, which is what I'm assuming, there should be some mapping to the outcomes. Okay? And from one run of the experiment to another, of course, there is going to be, you know, different outcomes. You don't get the same outcomes all the time. And this is explained by the fact that there's some distribution of hidden variables lambda. Now, okay, and you want for the hidden variables theory to work, it should get harder to draw. If the hidden variables theory is going to work, the statistics of these outcomes has to reproduce quantum correlation. Now, for that to happen, it was shown by Bell that this mapping has to be non-local. What that means here is that these outcomes are functions. The outcome at one wing has to be a function of the setting of the other wing. And here I'm writing something, and strictly speaking, not necessary. The theorem really tells you that this non-local dependence has to exist in at least one direction. Okay, it could be that for one of these things, this is missing. And I'm going to assume that there is a dependence from B to A. So this outcome does depend on what. So in at least one direction, there's this non-locality. And if you do have that, then we know you can reproduce quantum correlation. If I take the expectation value of the product of the outcomes for a particular distribution of hidden variables, so here I've got A, let me just write it like that, then I can get the correlation of quantum system. Okay, so now the thing is, so as I pointed out to you on Tuesday, just for a single two-state system, if I have a non-standard distribution of hidden, but once I've constructed this theory, such a theory, I can keep this, I can keep the mapping, the same mapping, but I can consider an arbitrary distribution of hidden variables that is not equal to the specific one that gives you quantum theory. And this means that the statistics of outcomes at each wing are going to be different. Here in quantum theory, you get these values with a ratio 1:1, okay? And the same at the other wing. If I have a different distribution of hidden variables, generically, the ratios are not going to be 1:1. But more interesting or more relevant is that if you change in quantum, sorry, I was also saying quantum theory, it's also true, no matter what, well, here, in this theory, with this equilibrium distribution, if I change the setting over here, while it's true that some outcomes over here are going to change, the statistics doesn't change. I'm still going to get plus or minus in a 1:1 ratio, so there's no signal in equilibrium. Okay? But for a non-standard distribution in general, if I switch the setting here, the marginal statistics over here will change, just like in that example of the boxes with the Breuer-Bohm theory. And the key point here is that if you imagine that this is the set of hidden variables, and let's consider. Say two settings. There's M A and B, and there's another setting, M B prime. I'm considering two setups, A and B, and then another one where I change the setting over here. So what will happen? Now remember, this is a deterministic theory. Given these settings, these equations tell you which values of lambda will give you plus. At A, so these are, let's here, this is my set of outcomes at A. Okay, there's plus one and minus one. Okay, there's going to be a partitioning of the set determined by these equations to tell you that the lambdas in here all map to plus one and the lambdas in here all map to minus one. Now, if I choose a different setting at B, you're going to get something like this. Let's say this is with a new setting at B. There, you're going to get something like this. With a new setting at B, the values of lambda will give you plus at A are these, and these values will give you minus. There's going to be a region. There are going to be values of lambda, which I call sort of transition set. It's the set of values of lambda for which you do get plus over there with the original setting, but when you change the setting at a distance, the result is flipped from plus to minus. Okay, and similarly, there's another transition set going the other way. Now, all that's happening here is that for the equilibrium measure, if I define this quantum measure, find with respect to the standard distribution of hidden variables. All that's happening is that for that measure, the measures of these two sets are equal. So what does that mean? It's just saying this, over an ensemble, when I tweak the axis of measurement here, some of the outcomes over there are flipping from plus to minus. Okay, for some percentage of the trials, they flip from plus to minus. But then there's another percentage of the trials for which the outcomes, when I do this, flip from minus to plus. Okay. And in equilibrium, these two transitions balance perfectly. Just like in thermal equilibrium, the condition of detailed balancing maintains thermal equilibrium. So here, you know, you're flipping your equipment, you want to send this signal, and in a sense, you know, the outcomes over there are flipping. There's a plus is turning into minus, minus turning to plus, but they're compensating exactly, so that the marginal statistics over there is unaffected. And clearly, for a generic measure on this set, defined by some arbitrary distribution, in general, the measure, you write it here, the measure of this set is not going to equal the measure of that set, and so there's going to be a net imbalance in the shift over there, so the marginal statistics will change at a distance. Okay, so this feature that you get signaling outside of quantum equilibrium, it's not a peculiarity of the Roy-Bohm theory, it's in any deterministic hidden variables theory, generically, this will happen. So what else? I mean, I'm telling you that from a hidden variables point of view, quantum theory is a theory of a special state, a special distribution of hidden parameters. And remember we discussed that, well, so this suggests that one should look for sort of wider physics of non-equilibrium, much of the physics of quantum theory, the constraints of quantum theory are not fundamental laws, they're contingencies of the state, and one example is signal locality. Okay, signal locality is not fundamental law, it's just as the inability to turn heat into work is not a fundamental law in global thermal equilibrium. Okay. So what other properties of quantum theory are just contingent? Well, there are all sorts of things. As you can imagine, almost everything that could go wrong does go wrong. But there's one thing that seems to me particularly worth mentioning, is non-additive expectations. Quantum theory has, part of the reason I'm going to mention this is because it gives a nice signature at the end of this talk. I want to get on to discussing how one would search for non-equilibrium in the universe. So what sort of simple physical observable signature would there be? This gives, I think, a nice approach to this. So, and it's interesting in its own right. So in quantum theory, let's say I have two non-commuting observables. Okay? Now, in quantum theory, I can do an experiment to measure omega 1. I can do another experiment to measure omega 2. These two experiments are going to be macroscopically distinct. Okay, I can't do both experiments at the same time. They're incompatible experiments. I can also do a third experiment to measure some linear combination. Here, alpha 1 and alpha 2 are real numbers. What you can do is get a third experiment, also incompatible. I have three different experiments. You know, this might be, say, might be, for example, a Stern girl. I've got a single spin half. I measure the spin along one axis. That's omega 1. Or I measure a spin along the x-axis. That's omega 2. And this might be spin along some intermediate axis. Okay, that's three different experiments. Quantum theory has this amazing property that the statistics of these three different experiments are related linearly, and that the expectation values add up. Okay. Now this is a trivial consequence in quantum theory. It's a trivial consequence of the fact that the Born rule is linear. Okay, the expectation value, this is a trace of the density operator times this, the trace is a linear operation, expectations are additive, obvious. Of course, they're additive, and why would anyone expect anything different? So, from a hidden variables perspective, this additivity is really strange. And the fact that it was strange is an interesting history that von Neumann, in his book published in 1932, claimed to prove not only that you need non-local hidden variables to reproduce quantum theory, he claimed that any hidden variables theory could not agree with quantum theory. And his argument involved, he said, what he was basically saying, sort of in my language, would be, imagine there is what he called a dispersion-free state, which would mean, in my point of view, a non-equilibrium distribution that is a sort of delta concentrated on one value of lambda, a dispersion-free state. So in other words, you know, if I repeat this experiment with the same conditions, the same settings, I'm always going to get the same outcome. you know, and there's a sort of interesting aspect of von Neumann's argument that he sort of equated the idea of the existence of hidden variables with the existence of dispersion-free states, which is a sort of extreme non-equilibrium, but anyway. Now, the thing is, von Neumann then, he writes down this general mathematical scheme, and he has an assumption that expectation values are additive. It seems obvious why expectation values are going to be additive, and he then derives a contradiction. So, there's a contradiction between the existence of these dispersion-free states and what seem very reasonable and general axioms. So von Neumann concluded, no hidden variables theory can agree with quantum theory. Bell says von Neumann, 1932, and Bell, in 1966, showed that, well, from a hidden variables point of view, expectation additivity is not a very reasonable general assumption, as von Neumann claimed, but it's totally unreasonable. And he gave this simple example. Let's say I've got a single two-state system. And let's consider, say I'm measuring, so these are axes. Maybe I shouldn't do this, because it's going to confuse you later. Okay, let me use a different. Okay, it doesn't matter. No, let me do this. So N3. So let's say I'm considering measuring along these three different axes. A spin half. Okay, it could be long x, could be long z, it could be long intermediate x. Now, what are the observables? Well, it's the Pauli spin operator. Okay, so what we have is we have this equality. This is just an operator quality from quantum theory. Okay, that the spin operator along N3 is this linear combination of spin operators along x and z. Okay, so far. Quantum theory then says that the expectation value of this is equal to 1 over root 2 expectation value plus 1 over root 2 expectation value. Okay, that looks fine so far. The problem is that in a hidden variables theory, if you measure along any axis, in quantum theory, the outcome of any of these measurements is always plus or minus 1, okay? Now, if I have a hidden variables theory of this form, given m, whatever m is, and lambda it outputs plus or minus 1, if I have a dispersion-free ensemble like this, then the expectation value, right here, the expectation value of sigma is just the value of this function at lambda 0. Okay, lambda 0 is the, all lambdas have this value, dispersion free ensemble. So if I assume expectation additivity, I mean, this is okay for quantum theory, quantum equilibrium. If I assume that this is true, even for this dispersion-free state, even for these dispersion-free expectation values, the result we get is that sigma free lambda 0 has to equal 1 over root 2 sigma m1 plus 1 over root 2 sigma m2, which is impossible. Because these sigmas have values, they all take values plus or minus 1, it's impossible with a root 2 that this, you're going to get this equality. So this is not true for any lambda. For any lambda, it's not true. Okay, in a dispersion-free state, expectation values simply cannot be linearly related like this. So Bell's point was that, well, von Neumann's reasonable assumption was completely unreasonable. Okay, good. So the relevance for us, what I want to add to Bell's point, is that, well, apart from a dispersion tree ensemble, let's just consider an arbitrary ensemble that is not equal to the quantum one. What have we got here? This is true for any value of lambda 0. In fact, I can rub out 0 and just tell you that the value, these are plus or minus 1, the value of a particular lambda of the outcome along here cannot equal this linear conformation for any value of lambda. So I have these two quantities that are unequal for all values of lambda. When you average over the quantum distribution of lambdas, they become equal, so to coincide with quantum theory, okay, assuming it's a theory that reproduces quantum theory. So you have this funny situation. These quantities are unequal for every value of lambda. There exists a distribution of lambdas such that when you average over them, they become equal. The averages become equal. But clearly, in general, the quantum, the non-equilibrium expectation values are not going to be this combination. Okay, it's a sort of miracle, as it were, of a particular distribution. So it's a miracle of the equilibrium state. Another, just as you have this other miracle from this point of view that, you know, you have these non-local effects, I'm changing the setting here and things are flipping from plus to minus to plus, it happens to balance perfectly in equilibrium and there's no signal. Similarly, expectation additivity is a peculiar feature of this state. So now there's another interesting, and actually I'd just like to say, it seems to me that a lot of work has been done on sort of Bell theorem and Cochran Specter and so on. It seems to me that there's more, that this point about expectation additivity for non-commuting observables is something that's a bit neglected in the foundation literature, maybe. Work on it a bit more. For two reasons. One that it's from a hidden variable point of view is really strange, and it's obviously strange. It's not like Bell theorem, the Cochran Specter, where you have to do some work to prove this theorem and show that there's a problem. Here it's, you know, simple to see that there's a glaring contradiction in general between a hidden variable theory with a non-standard distribution and expectation additivity. The other thing is that expectation additivity is very powerful. There's a very simple, fairly simple proof that you can derive the Born rule. If you assume that this is true, you know, for arbitrary linear combinations of arbitrary numbers of observables, you can derive the Born rule. If you want to see, in effect, von Neumann proved that in 1932, but his proof is sort of messy. There's a nice proof of just a few lines. If you look at Ballantyne's Reviews of Modern Physics article, which I'm sure you've looked at, his article on the statistical interpretation. I never remember if it's 1970 or 71.
It's available on the webpage.
Is it 70 or 71? Anyway.
I think it was 70.
So you'll find there one of the last sections. This is literally just four or five lines. It's, you derive the Born rule from this. One can show for the simple case of the two-state system, there's a particularly simple proof, which I'm going to show you because it also then relates to the signature I want to talk about. So just briefly, I want to show you that, maybe I'm not really going to go into it in all the detail, but just give you the idea, essential idea, that this is equivalent to additive expectations. Okay, you remember that this expectation value is the trace of rho hat m dot sigma hat, which is just m dot p, where this is the mean polarization of the ensemble. Okay, there's some vector in block space Why is that equivalent to expectation additivity? Well, if you think about, if I take a basis, an orthonormal basis in block space 1, 2, 3, and an arbitrary vector can be expanded in this basis, okay? And that means that the spin observable associated with that arbitrary axis is just a linear combination of the observables associated with the three axes, okay? Now, if you assume expectation additivity, if you assume that these expectations are linearly related, then by using the fact that this has to be, I mean, this just depends on M, it can't depend on what basis you're using. So if you do a rotation of this basis, sort of orthonormal basis, for this to be invariant, so these things have to be the components of a vector. Of a vector in block space. Okay, and that's how it works. So this just to give you an idea of the power of expectation additivity, it actually fixes the quantum probability. So now, so for now we can turn this around and say, well, I want to use this I want to talk about, okay, so I've been telling you, been asking you to believe quantum theory is not fundamental, that it's the phenomenological description of a particular distribution of hidden variables, okay, this thing is a consistent point of view. I've shown you how, in the Breuer-Bohm theory at least, you can understand how the distribution that we see could have come about from earlier complicated interactions. Remember I showed you these numerical simulations. So, because there is the issue now, well, what, okay, so you have this picture, but how do you test this? What, you know, why should I believe that there are really these hidden variables? Why should I believe that there is this wider physics of non-equilibrium that no one's ever seen? Isn't the whole thing just a kind of, you know, a con in some sense? So now the awkward thing is, from the point of view of these theories, especially the de Broglie, where you have a demonstration, a reasonable demonstration, you actually get this relaxation. From the point of view of these theories, given that we know that every system we see has interacted in a complex way in the past through its astrophysical history, you would expect to see equilibrium, okay? I mean, you know, if you believe these theories, it's not as if we're putting in equilibrium to hide the stuff just for the sake of agreeing with the experiment. Now, hang on, I mean, here you would expect to see what we see. So, I mean, it's a bit like, you know, when Galileo was trying to convince people that the Earth was moving, people would say, well, I don't feel it moving. You know, why am I going? So you have to show, I mean, Galileo could show you that there are physical reasons. Well, you would expect this. You would not feel that you're moving. But that's not really enough. That just shows that there's a sort of consistency. If you really want to convince people, and I've been working on this for years, and still people aren't convinced, so. If you really want to convince people, then of course you need some new experimental thing. I mean, no one, I don't think it's, and I think quite rightly, from a scientific point of view, to accept this picture without there being some sort of experiment that shows the existence of non-equilibrium and would just be unreasonable. So let's look for quantum non-equilibrium, looking for violations of quantum theory. So how are we going to do that? Well, first of all, here's what seems to me, I'm sure one could do something cleverer than this. I think Lucien has got a paper in a draft form in a drawer somewhere that has a clever scheme. But anyway, I'll just show you what I came up with. Let's say I fire photons one at a time at a polarizer. It's a linear polarizer. Okay. And let's say after this that there's another polarizer, which I'm not sure terribly well, but the axis is rotated by some angle theta with respect to the first. Now, quantum theory says that the transmission probability through the second polarizer is equal to cos squared of the angle. Okay, what comes out of here is a perfectly polarized state, is Malus' law. And from the point of view of what we've been doing, so this is a two-state system where these values plus or minus one now correspond to polarization parallel. I don't know if people use this in Canada, but my lectures in England need to use this. Means parallel, this means perpendicular to the axis of polarization. So, you know, either, well, basically, either it comes through or it doesn't come through. Okay, that's plus or minus one. And these observables, one can consider them existing again in this abstract free space, block space, where you have to be careful that the angle theta in the block space corresponds to, hang on, I'm going to get this the wrong way around. So, yeah, theta over 2 in the block space corresponds to this physical angle in free space. You know this stuff. So the point is now, in general, so in a hidden variable theory, there's some, we've seen this before, there's some expectation value for the outcome. The individual is plus or minus one, there's some expectation value over the ensemble. And one plus this times a half is the transmission probability. Angle theta. Okay, it's just there are only two possibilities. Probability of plus is just one plus the expectation value over two. In quantum theory, as I said to you in general, this is one plus n dot p. The expectation is n dot p, which is a half one plus p cos two theta is two because of the angle is. Okay, and this is cos squared theta if it's perfectly polarized. Here, what's coming out of the first polarized, perfectly polarized. Okay, so that's Malus' law. So now the point is, we've seen that this, having an expectation value equal to this, is expectation additivity. And expectation additivity is equivalent to the quantum probabilities here. So this sinusoidal modulation of quantum theory, going like this, this is equivalent to expectation additivity for a two-state system, which we've seen, and this point goes back to Bell, really, that this is totally peculiar from an invariable point of view. It's a miracle of a particular distribution. So one way of looking for non-equilibrium distributions would be to, well, let's look at these bolons that we suspect might have something wrong with them. We're going to send them through one polarizer, then through a second polarizer, and we're going to look at the transmission as a function of angle. We're going to look for deviations from cos squared theta. Okay? That's what we're going to look for. Deviations from Malus' law. So that's what we want to look for. Well, one thing one might look for. Where are we going to look for it? Where are we going to look for it? Are we going to say, you know, go to the lab at the IQC and find some photons from a laser and do this experiment? Actually, something like that was done in the 60s. There was a theory by Bohm and Booth where it was a hidden variables theory, but in which, in a sense, the equilibrium distribution was sort of unstable. That if you did one measurement and then another measurement very quickly, immediately after, you would get deviation from quantum theory. So an experiment precisely like this was done by Papaglioni or something in the 60s, where you know, the I can't remember the time scale now, it was a very tiny time scale between these measurements, and he got the usual quantum malus law to an accuracy of something like 1%. Now, the thing is, from the point of view of these lectures, there's no reason, I mean, I wouldn't expect photons in the lab, where they come from some atom that's been interacting with things for a long time. This thing came out of some star that exploded. It came out of, you know, condensation of galaxies. It came out of the Big Bang. All this stuff has been interacting for so long, it's going to have relaxed to equilibrium long ago. I wouldn't expect any photon in the lab to show anything peculiar. But what you might wonder is, so there is a sort of natural idea, not necessarily a logical consequence, but it seems a natural idea that the universe could have started out in a state of non-equilibrium. So at very early times, there could have existed particles with these peculiar probabilities. What I want to do, so one place you might look is relics from the early universe. Okay. Another place you might look is through inflation, which I said a bit about yesterday. I'm just going to say something again. The third place you might look, and I'm not really going to give details about these two. I'm going to give you details about the third one, also because I've got a couple of papers on the archive about it, is, as I mentioned, there is already, in ordinary thermal physics, there's this peculiarity of gravity, that it amplifies temperature differences. Could it be that in gravity, there is some way of actually generating non-equilibrium? Okay? Instead of looking for something left over from some hypothetical non-equilibrium state in the past, could we today, okay, even though these things have all interacted, they're all in equilibrium, is there a way of knocking things out of equilibrium? So there's an idea about gravity involving black holes. So I'm going to go into some detail on this. But first, let me just say briefly, it's the idea of relics from the early universe. So you know, for example, that as the universe expands and cools, various particles decouple. So for example, when the temperature of the universe is about 3,000 or 4,000 Kelvin, and electrons and protons combine to form atoms, it becomes transparent and photons no longer scatter, and they just propagate freely from then on. And this is the microwave, and then of course the universe expands, there's a redshift, and we see these as a microwave background. The microwave background photons are relics from the time when the universe was about 300,000 or 400,000 years old. There's a similar story about neutrinos. So there are photons. The neutrinos, there's a similar story about neutrinos. They're believed to have decoupled about 1 second after the Big Bang. Going back earlier, it is expected that gravitons decoupled at the time about the Planck time, or soon after the Planck time. And it is believed, most people believe this, that there is a sort of analog of the microwave background for gravitons. There is this sea of gravitons which may or may not be in thermal equilibrium, but should exist, and of course we can't detect it presently. So one idea is that while the earlier particles are decoupled so early, could be, might be, out of equilibrium, you might say, well, hang on, the further back in time you go, the higher the temperature is, the stronger the interactions are. Surely, as you approach the singularity, everything will have been driven to equilibrium very quickly. Well, so you have to be careful because, so at very early times, the scale factor, a little bit of cosmology, is just telling you the factor by which length scales in free space are stretching. The scale factor at early times goes like the square root of t. Okay, from as a consequence of the Einstein equation, if I have a radiation-dominated universe where particles are essentially massless compared to the physical energies, you have this. This means that the expansion rate, the rate at which at which spatial distances are expanding, goes like 1 over t, which tends to infinity. So what this means, at very early times, the rate at which the universe is expanding tends to infinity. Now, it turns out that you can show this in de Broglie-Bohm theory, that when you have a stretching of space, roughly speaking, if I have a wave function, say this is psi squared, and I have a probability distribution that has some deviation, okay, but rho is approaching psi squared, it's relaxing to equilibrium, there can be a sort of compensating effect that if the spatial scale here is being stretched up, then the length scale on which you have these deviations gets expanded. So what this means is, so there are two competing effects. There's one effect that is making things relax to equilibrium, and the expansion of space is stretching things up again. So if the expansion rate at sufficiently early times is bigger than the relaxation rate, then relaxation will actually be suppressed. And if you're familiar with sort of early sort of Big Bang cosmology, this kind of argument is used a lot this idea that, say, neutrinos decouple at a certain temperature. What that is, when the expansion rate of the universe has diminished to a point where it's less than the sort of rate of collisions of neutrinos with other particles, then the neutrinos drop out of equilibrium. Okay, they're no longer interacting sufficiently quickly. Anyway, so there is, if you want to know more, there's a paper on the archive in 2001 that's about this. But the relaxation rates, we only have crude estimates for the relaxation rates in the early universe. So but anyway, there is a possibility. Another possibility that I mentioned a bit on Tuesday is that in inflation, the primordial density perturbations are supposed to have come from quantum vacuum fluctuations in the early universe. And the statistics of those fluctuations are now imprinted on the microwave background. So there's a sense in which inflation is a test. If it happened, it is a test of quantum theory at very early times. And if you consider non-standard distributions for vacuum fields in the early universe, you do get differences from the inflationary predictions for the statistics that were measured. So that's another possibility. But now let me give you in some detail this third possibility. I've got 20 minutes. Do I know? I just need that. Okay. So let me go to this third possibility. So gravity. I can just move that up. Okay. So how does gravity fit with quantum theory? So no one really knows. No one really knows. There are theories, the string theory, there's loop quantum gravity. To some extent they work, to some extent they don't work. But certainly, let's say there's no accepted theory of quantum gravity. It's not like quantum electrodynamics, quantum chromodynamic gravity. We're not sure really how it fits with quantum theory. So, as I told you, we have an example of the hidden variables theory neglecting gravity, with the de Broglie-Bohm theory, which has also been extended to field theory, in which once you're in this quantum equilibrium state, you're stuck there. Okay, but possibly if we introduce gravity in some future theory, perhaps gravity disturbs quantum equilibrium. Maybe. Just a speculation. Okay. So far, just an idea, a thought. It turns out that already, there are reasons, not completely conclusive, but there are reasons to believe that, so there exist, let's say, arguments that gravity modifies the usual rules of quantum theory. Essentially, that gravity modifies unitary evolution. These arguments have nothing to do with hidden variables. They're independent arguments to do with black holes, which I'll sketch in a moment. I'm going to say what these arguments are. But let me just first say there are already arguments that something strange happens to quantum theory in the presence of gravity. So it sort of, to my mind, adds to this possibility. Oh, well, maybe quantum equilibrium is disturbed in gravity. So let's pursue it further in a way that is actually related to this. Okay, it's going to be fun. I'm just mumbling now, but that's a fun thing. So let me sketch what is the argument that seems to cause trouble for quantum theory. So Hawking, the paper in 1976, Israel D, has the following argument. So imagine I have, let's say in the distant past, I have a large number of particles. Okay, so this is the far past. Okay. Where it's very dilute, approximately in constant space-time, it's sort of flat, it's probably spread out, and this whole system of all these particles is in a pure state. Okay, it's in a pure state. Now imagine that these particles, this gravitational attraction, the whole thing collapses. Okay, so I'm going, time is going up here. The whole thing collapses to form a black hole. Okay, black hole. Now, black hole, if you've all done general relativity, the black hole, the surface of the black hole, once something goes in, it can't come out again unless it goes faster than light. Look, okay, so it just, you go in, it can't come out again. The other thing about the black hole is that classically, once it's formed, in classical general relativity, the external geometry of the hole is fixed by just three parameters, the mass, the charge, and the angular momentum that went in, which was a sort of surprise to a lot of people when this was figured out in the 60s and 70s. Because you might think that if I had matter, you know, with some complicated initial configuration, it falls in the form of black hole, that afterwards, from the outside, the geometry would depend on the details that went in. But in fact, there's a kind of smoothing out. In the far future, the asymptotic geometry, you know, at large time, doesn't care about what went in except for the total mass, charge, and angular momentum. It's called the no-hair theorem. And it's a kind of, if you like, a sort of classical information loss. Now, information about what went in is just erased. That's just classically. Okay? But now, continuing with his argument, once the black hole is formed, Hawking then showed, I mean, he had shown earlier before this paper, he had shown that from quantum effects, which I'll discuss a little bit in a second, I mean, classically, the black hole, once it's formed, you know, more stuff can go in, but nothing is supposed to be able to come out again. And there were theorems that, you know, the mass can never decrease. The mass of the black hole is never supposed to decrease. But Hawking showed that from quantum effects, actually, the black hole would radiate with a temperature that's inversely proportional to the mass. And, you know, for large black holes, this temperature is utterly tiny, tiny. But still, in principle, you get a thermal radiation, okay, which decreases over time. The mass of the hole decreases. And the argument was that eventually, well, the mass of the hole would just decrease. Of course, for those of you, you know, the sort of radius of a black hole is sort of a order. Well, actually, there's a gravitational constant, gm over c squared. For a Schwarzschild black hole, it's twice this. If it's spinning, it's a bit more complicated. Anyway, roughly, the event horizon, the radius of the event horizon is approximately this. As the mass decreases, this thing just shrinks and shrinks and shrinks, and in the end, maybe there would be some sort of explosion. And in the far future, okay, you've just got thermal radiation. Well, I mean, black hole has a particular temperature of a certain mass. As the mass evaporates, the temperature is getting hotter and hotter. All this stuff is radiated away. In the far future, you're left with just radiation of all kinds of particles in a mixed state rho. Okay. And the argument is that, well, if I, in principle here, if I take a closed system that's initially in a pure quantum state, through gravitational collapse followed by Hawking evaporation, the whole system, this closed system, can evolve from a pure to a mixed state, which is not supposed to happen in quantum theory. Now, this argument is controversial, and you've probably heard that Hawking, quite recently, after 30 years of defending this, says he's changed his mind and he thinks that there's something wrong with this now and it doesn't. This pure. So the original argument is that you have a pure to mixed transition. Okay. Now, goes to, say you've got a rho hat in, pure, goes to a rho hat out that is mixed. Now, opinion is very much divided on this argument. This is clearly a sort of semi-classical argument. You have this classical background space-time on which you do quantum field theory. There are various ways in which you can question this, okay? But I think it's fair to say that most people think that the argument as it stands is reasonable. Where people differ is what one should do about this. People coming from a background in general relativity tend to think that, yes, there are pure to mixed state transitions, and quantum theory needs to be generalized. So people like Unruh and Wald will accept this and say, look, this is fine. Most people in the high energy physics string theory think that this is an awful conclusion. Unitarity is violated. This cannot be. And they do take this argument seriously. In fact, a lot of work that's done in string theory and N theory, holography, these things, you've heard ABS, CFT correspondence, you've heard about these things, are motivated by trying to avoid this conclusion. Okay, there is a claim that in some deeper theory, really there's unitary evolution, and somehow it just appears to be non-unitary. Those ideas, they're interesting, but they're not complete. So it's very much unknown, really, what the state is. But let's say there is a reasonable argument here that perhaps in nature this thing exists. Now, the peculiarity here, this is often called information loss. The reason it's called information loss is that the out state, it's just, the state of the radiated particles. You remember I told you that external geometry only depends on these parameters. And the temperature, I said, well, the temperature is inversely proportional to the mass. For a black hole that's rotating with charge, the temperature also depends on the charge and angular momentum. It's a bit more complicated than this. But that's all it depends on. So in other words, what comes out, this radiated mass, all this radiation has come out. The state, the out state, essentially just depends on the mass and angular momentum that went in. It doesn't depend on the details of the initial quantum state far in the past. Okay. So what that means is, if you're given the final state, you cannot retrodict the initial state. Okay? You can't retrodict the initial state. So people call it information loss. Okay? Information about initial quantum state is somehow lost. Some people accept that, some people worry about it. There are proposals that, I think Hawking was one of the first, that this kind of process could be taking place on microscopic scales, near the Planck scale, and imagine sort of virtual black holes forming and evaporating. And on those grounds, a number of people have proposed that because of sort of microscopic Planck scale physics, that the standard quantum mechanical evolution, the density operator, should be modified with some extra terms, okay, that makes this evolution non-unitary. And people propose, people have models of these things and propose various tests. Okay, so that's the state of that. So what I want to propose is that if such transitions exist, then in their presence, quantum non-equilibrium might be generated for these radiated particles. Now, how might that work?
Can I do just a simple question? Has anyone showed that it's actually possible for a system in a pure state to go into a black hole?
So some people dispute that, actually. There is actually a paper by Rob Myers, who's here, and he claims, for reasons to do with string theory, which I don't think I could reproduce, but he claims, the title of his paper is something called Pure States Don't Wear Black. He claims that a pure state simply will not collapse from a black hole. And it is to do with string theory. I can't remember what the reasoning is. But that's certainly, most people wouldn't, don't think that. So most people's mind was, why shouldn't it collapse? But certainly one can ask these questions. So that issue has been raised by some people, but not by me. Sorry.
Maybe this has nothing to do with it, but can't you also play by entangling stuff and sending part of it into a black hole?
I'm just going to come to that. That's just what I'm going to do. Good. Okay, so what? Why might one think, or how could non-equilibrium be generated maybe here? Okay, so here is, so we started late, so I have another 10 minutes. Is that okay? Okay. So let me just tell you, people familiar with conformal diagrams? Let me just briefly. So here's a beautiful diagram invented by Carter and Penrose. Here's Minkowski space-time. So I can introduce coordinates. Go like this. This is t minus x. Is 0, 1, 2, minus 1. Okay, t minus x. And I can go this way. I've got coordinates t plus x. Okay, so if I introduce coordinates u and v, so the t minus x, t plus x, I can introduce, okay. What you can then do, there's a transformation. These coordinates go from minus infinity to infinity. There's a transformation involving a tangent function that just squashes this down into a finite width. So you end up with Minkowski space-time, oops, that looks like this. Not drawing very well. Where this picture here, this is the past, this is the future. For time-like world lines all start here and they all end up here. Light-like lines all go here. This is the infinite future for life. And this is just a way of drawing Minkowski space-time in a little finite piece. So the reason I'm introducing that is because this is what the collapse and subsequent evaporation of a black hole is supposed to look like, according to most people in this business, that here I have this stuff collapsing. Here is the singularity. You don't want to go there. Okay. Here is the horizon, the event horizon. If you're in here, remember light, so time-like world lines go like this, light goes like this. To go out, you have to go faster than light. Once you're in here, you're going to hit the singularity. So you don't want to fall behind it. But after the evaporation, here you are in Minkowski space, and it's actually just half that picture. So now, what is happening? Why do you get a pure to mixed transition? One way of thinking about this pure to mixed transition is the following. Imagine that here is some time, a particular time, space-like slice, on which there is a pure quantum state. It's the evolution of the initial quantum state from which this thing collapsed. Okay. Now, what happens is, outside, in this region outside the horizon, okay, I can define a reduced density operator just for the path, just by tracing over the internal degrees of freedom. Okay, so I get a mixed and a sort of effective density operator for outside. The total state is really pure. Okay, so far so good. What happens once the black hole has evaporated? The interior degrees of freedom that you've traced over just don't exist anymore. And you're left with, on this hypersurface now, on this sort of space now after the black hole has disappeared, you're left with a mixed state, which is strictly a mixed state. It's not just an effective mixed state obtained from tracing over some degrees of freedom behind the horizon. It's strictly mixed. Okay? Now, there's no way you could retrodict this the initial state from this state, as I said. Now, the idea is that if this radiation is in a state of quantum non-equilibrium, then it will contain more degrees of freedom and more information in its statistics than quantum theory allows. And retrodiction might be possible. So that's a motivation for considering, that this process generates non-equilibrium, is that there is then a possibility that, well, the final state is not just a standard quantum mixed state, it could be out of equilibrium. And possibly this extra information contains, information about the initial state. Now, let me just give you, coming to your point, there's one way of visualizing the Hawking process, is that just outside the horizon, there are virtual pairs created, okay? And one of these pairs falls into the hole, and the other pair goes off to infinity, and this is what we see as radiation, okay? Strictly speaking, quantum field theory, these pairs correspond to the field modes that are entangled. So the point is, these virtual pairs are entangled, okay? So here is a mechanism. Let us say that something we don't understand happens near the singularity. Let us say that inside the black hole, there is non-equilibrium. Then you can show that for these entangled pairs, when one half interacts with these non-equilibrium degrees of freedom, what is left outside is knocked out of equilibrium. And let me give you, so there's a kind of leakage, a sort of non-local leaking of information to the outside. And let me give you an exercise for the students. Let's say, just in simple non-relativistic de Broglie theory, let's start with two particles that are entangled, some initial state that's entangled, okay? And let this particle interact locally with another particle for the quiet through this interaction that we've already played around with. So you can find the de Broglie, imagine that's the total Hamiltonian. You should be able to write down the de Broglie theory of this system. And you'll be able to show that if you start off with an initial distribution that is equilibrium for these pairs, okay, these are in equilibrium, but this half is interacting with a non-equilibrium system. So the joint distribution looks like this, where this is not equal to the quantum theory. Okay, so this has some wave function phi zero, So this is not pi zero squared. Then you should be able to show that calculate the marginal probability distribution for this by integrating over xa and y after you've calculated the evolution of this distribution. So the marginal distribution here gets knocked away from the quantum distribution if this is entangled. Okay. So here we have what is happening. You have an entangled pair. One half is falling in. If it interacts with non-equilibrium degrees of freedom behind the horizon, this will be knocked out of equilibrium. So there's a possible mechanism here that when this stuff evaporates, that what comes out is actually out of equilibrium. And you know, an out of equilibrium state contains more. It's not just described by the density operator. There is extra information to do with the actual distribution of hidden variables. Now, as you've said, if this happens, so let me say two things. First of all, people have done searches for Hawking radiation from primordial black holes left over from the early universe. This is a possibility in astrophysics. There's a certain predictive, I think it's in the gamma ray region. People have looked for specific gamma rays that might be emitted from, you know, black holes that formed at very early times and are now evaporating. There's no definitive evidence for those, but if they were found, then you might, those photons, one might do this test, you know, my test with the two polarizers to test Malus' law. But another thing one might do, which I think could be done now, is, well, if this funny thing happens for these virtual entangled pairs, well, why not just take any old entangled pair? It doesn't have to be a Hawking radiation entangled pair. Let's just take a pair of entangled photons that I generate in the lab, okay? So I'm going to do this. Hang on. Let's just say I have a black hole here. Here's the horizon. I prepare an EPR pair in an entangled state. I throw one half into the black hole. The other half, I do my double polarizer experiment, and I test C if I have a deviation from Malus' law. Okay, that sounds like a reasonable experiment to do. So first of all, we have some motivation here for, well, why this might be, you might get a difference from Malus' law. More generally, this would be, if you could do this experiment, it would be a sort of extreme test of quantum theory. You know, you still get Malus' law, which we've seen is peculiar from a hidden variable point of view, Malus' law. Is Malus' law still true for a photon that's entangled with a photon that's fallen inside a black hole? Good. So there's some motivation to do the test. Now you might say, I'm just going to take another three or four minutes. That's okay. Mm-hmm. How can we do this test? So we're not going to go to Ray Laflamme and ask him, he has a black hole in his lab, because he probably doesn't. So, but, you know, the universe is a laboratory, and most galaxies, including our galaxy, contain supermassive black holes at the center, with a mass in the region, whoops, 10 to the 10 solar masses. And evidence for this comes from studying of gas orbiting around the motion of stars in the region.
Is there a question?
All astrophysicists believe this now. It's been since the early mid-90s. The evidence for this is overwhelming. And in particular, so the supermassive black hole, believe they usually have a very thin, so if I sort of zoom in, it's supposed to be the whole galaxy, if I zoom in this region, there's supposed to be a very thin accretion disk around supermassive black hole whose height is much smaller than the radius. So any the height of the radius r is much smaller than the radius. It's a very thin thing. And this matter is, it actually doesn't go all the way to the event horizon. There's a gap for various reasons I won't go into for the radius of marginal stability. This stuff slowly goes around. When it reaches this point, it just spirals in, falls in freely into the black hole. Okay, and this theory of thin accretion has been very well worked out by astrophysicists since the 70s. But now here's an amazing thing that people have observed around 1995, that there are, in this disk, for various reasons, that there are X-rays hitting the surface of this disk from a corona up here, which I won't bother you with, and there are iron atoms in the surface that are being excited. Okay, you've actually got this, so the lowest level, the electron in the lowest level is ejected by this X-ray photon, and then the next electron falls down, and you get an X-ray photon emitted from this atom, an X-ray photon, and it's about 6.4 keV. It's a very well-studied iron line. Okay, and people have detected this. So here's the Earth, and we have a satellite. There was a Japanese satellite that detected this line in the mid-90s. And what they found was that the flux, I mean, this is, to me, a really fantastic observation. This line, intrinsically, is very narrow. It's a very narrow line. The flux that they found of this line had this funny shape. It's sort of skewed, and it has this red wing. And around the same time, some astrophysicists in Cambridge, in England, show that if you take into account the fact, so what we're observing here is emission from very close to the horizon, okay, to within a factor of two. The emission radius in some of these observations is less than a factor of two within the radius of the horizon, but very close to the hole. So there are Doppler effects, there's gravitational time dilation, the red shifts the photon, and you can calculate the effect of, you know, given an intrinsic line that's narrow, what line, what shape of line would you see? And the theory agrees very well with what is observed. And things have now got so detailed that from the observed shape, you can tell how much the hole is rotating and so on and so on. Okay, so this is pretty much established. So what does that mean for our experiment? I want to do this experiment. I want to take an entangled pair and throw one half into that black hole and make measurements on the other half. How am I going to do that? So here's a way of doing it. Let's imagine that, so far they are, this is the main thing that's been observed is iron line. People have also looked for other transitions from other elements. Let's say that at some point, we discover that there is a cascade. There's an atom. There are some atoms in here that are undergoing a cascade emission. Okay, so an electron drops down, it drops down, and it emits a pair of entangled photons. Okay, now you'll remember from Alan Aspect's talk that what they did in the lab, they had these. There's certainly this calcium they use. There is a cascade emission that emits pairs of photons, and these pairs are entangled. Okay, and if the momenta of the photons are approximately oppositely directed, then the polarization is very strongly entangled, and you have a phase coherent entanglement of the polarization. So what we need here is, if there is a transition that emits a pair of photons, one that sort of goes this way and one that goes this way, they're approximately oppositely directed, okay? And this one falls into the black hole and the other one reaches Earth, then there you go. The photons that we receive, let's do this test with the two polarizers and see if it obeys Mahler's law. So I'm just going to very quickly in 1 minute say a few issues that arise. Well, one is How do you know, by the way, anyone who's interested can look at, there's a reference somewhere. A few issues is, one is, how are you going to know that the emissions are approximately oppositely directed? Okay, it turns out that people worked out in the 70s the detailed geometry of these emissions, and it is a fact that a photon that's emitted very close to the horizon, most of them, they either, because this is, you know, the gravity here is very strong and space-time is a curve, most of them, they either fall back into the hole or they hit the disk. And it turns out that if you're very close to the horizon, for a photon to escape to infinity, it has to be emitted almost parallel to the disk. So that means it doesn't matter what line of sight, even if we're up here, a photon that reaches us. What I'm saying is, if you look at the photons from the red wing, which these are the photons that were emitted closest to the horizon, okay? For those photons emitted close to the horizon, for them to have reached us, they had to be emitted almost parallel to the disk. This is known. So you have a sort of rough, you know, oppositely directed pairs for the ones we see if you restrict yourself to photons from the red wing. The main problem at the moment is that the only line that is really well established is this X-ray line. Okay. Now it seems that these photons do have a small, or at least a small percentage of them, do have entangled partners, but it's a small percentage, something like 0.1%. And so the main problem is, you can't do, remember the experiment here, we need to do two polarization measures, a polarizer and a second polarizer. There's no known way of doing two polarization measurements on an X-ray photon. The techniques they have that use the photoelectric effect actually destroys the photon. So the hope is that one will find, in a more convenient frequency band, that one will find a cascade emission close to the event horizon of a supermassive black hole. And in that way, this experiment might be done, and we'll see what the result is. Thank you very much.
The particle, as that slide earlier.
A particle and
a set of black hole. It can contain information about its antiparticle that's trapped in the black hole. And then maybe contain information that this antiparticle is eventually radiated via schemes. I think if the black hole radiates heat, eventually loses mass. Is it possible that like, an antiparticle eventually loses mass? And,
I'm a little bit confused about what you mean. So here's the event horizon. So in the Hawking process, the picture is that you get these particle-antiparticle pairs. One falls in, and one is the other that you see. This is the radiation that you see. Now you're saying that if this contains information about this one that went in, then what? Then I think
eventually if a black hole does radiate massive, yeah. a small structure.
Like this thing here.
Yeah, could that contain information about the antiparticle actually?
Because because it sounds to me as if you're just repeating yourself. Because this is the radiation that comes out. So I mean, if this has a non-equilibrium distribution, for example, these particles are passing through these terapolarizers. And if I measure the transmission probability as a function of angle, instead of getting cos squared theta, I might get something else. And this distribution effectively contains more information than quantum theory. So, I mean, that is a proposal that will happen. Okay.
Okay, so you're talking about being black holes because you expect singularity to get, maybe get a big deviation.
It's a big deviation.
But you talk about this coming as just sort of a general gravitational feature. So even if, would you expect smaller fields to make smaller effects? And then it seems like it would be a lot easier to just try to do a much larger sample in a much smaller field, and then even if your deviation is only, you know, 2%, it's a lot easier to throw photons to the sun than trying to find a central hole.
Sure, that's fair enough. So, who knows? Maybe just ordinary gravitational fields do something strange. The thing about this proposal is that with the case of black holes, there is already an independent argument that is quite strong, if controversial, that says that something strange happens with quantum theory anyway. You get a pure to mixed transition. And information about the initial state is lost. And if you look in the literature, people have tried all sorts of ways to see, could the outgoing radiation somehow contain more information than we think? Does it have some strange correlations or something from which you can reconstruct the initial state? And usually proposals don't work. So, you know, there are other motivations for thinking, in the case of black holes, that the exterior state could have something strange about it. So putting the two together, you know, this seems the natural direction to look in. But sure, possibly it's just gravity generally does something strange.
If you wanted to test to see if originally we were started in a non-equilibrium condition, why can't you just use particles formed in a particle accelerator? So we could see if originally there do exist in non-equilibrium.
Right, yeah. So, okay. So you might be thinking that you know, particles are created out of nowhere, maybe they're born in non-equilibrium. So first I should say, in some hidden variables theories, maybe something like that happened. Okay. But in the one sort of well-developed theory we do have, the Broglie-Bohm theory, it seems that in the absence of gravity, you don't. You see, I mean, it's not as if you start from nothing. You start, let's say you have a photon, let's say you have pairs being created, you know, electron-positron pairs being created. You know, they don't just, there's always something before. There are fields, certainly from a field theory point of view. Maybe that's the best way to put it. I think this is the way I think about it. That from a field theory point of view, okay, at some initial time, you've got the electromagnetic field, you've got the electron positron field, the Dirac field, whatever it is, and you have a sort of hidden variable theory of these fields. Now, these fields are there, they're not just vanished or taking zero values, they're quantized, usually in quantum field they're quantized. And you know, you can have a situation where, let's say I have an initial vacuum state, that I have a background electric field, and you know, electron positron pairs are created. But from a field theory point of view, what you've really done, you've just changed the state of the field. It's not as if there was nothing there before. There were vacuum fields. And now you've just created a state where there are vacuum fields plus some extra field modes, which we interpret as particles. So from that point of view, well, if the initial vacuum fields are in a state of quantum equilibrium, you know, then the fields later on just inherit the earlier equilibrium state. So let's say from the point of view of the Broglie-Bohm quantum theory of fields, you wouldn't expect anything like that. But that's not to say that maybe in other hidden variables theories, maybe something like that would happen. And so maybe one could look for these things. The thing is, in high-energy physics, particle physics experiments, when people look at cross-sections, and they look at how, you know, the cross-section varies with angle, scattering cross-sections varying with angle, that is a test of the Born rule. I mean, if you'll remember, in a scattering process, you've got some amplitude that you get, and the mod squared of this amplitude from that you derive the cross section. You know, that is the Born rule. The experiments fit very well with the standard model of particle physics. So it doesn't look as if, you know, high energy scattering or particle creation annihilation that we see today, it seems to follow quantum theory. But still, it's an ideal thing.
Usually, thinking variables theory, I'm not covered in my undergraduate courses. So I just wondered if you could tell about the other possibilities of hidden variables, like what kind of ideas people suggested for which would be consistent with quantum theory, but how would have hidden variables aside from Born.
Aside from the Born, right? Okay, that's interesting because. To my knowledge, right? Okay, let's say if you're talking about something like say a single two-state system, you know, so where I've just got these outcomes plus or minus one, and I want some hidden variables theory that looks like this, gives me these outcomes. Then there are examples. You can cook up such theories quite easily. In fact, if you look in Bell's book, his original Bell inequality paper, he gives an example where this hidden variable is a sort of like a little vector that you imagine exists in this block space, and there's some rule for if this is the axis you're measuring along, and here is this vector, then there's some rule about the angle between these vectors that I don't remember that determines the outcome. And, you know, if this vector has some uniform distribution on the block sphere, you show you get the quantum prediction. So, you know, for little toy systems like that, you can cook up there are models. If you're asking for something with some sort of generality, say that would give you quantum theory for, you know, non-relativistic particles like the boson, you know, one particle, two particles moving in space and so on. The only theory that I know of that we really know works is the boson. There is the closest other theory is a theory that I don't feel that I ever really understood completely, but roughly, so it's due to Nelson. If you're interested, it's published in PhysRev, I think something like 1966. And what he started out with, so originally he just did it for one particle. He's got an electron, and it undergoes some sort of, it's a stochastic theory. This electron undergoes some kind of random motion, which it's a bit weird. It's a bit like a kind of Brownian motion, but it's a strange kind of Brownian. It's not normal Brownian motion. And what he does, with very certain assumptions about the diffusion of this thing, there is a sort of, so the velocity of this thing is fluctuating, but there's a sort of mean, I think it's a mean drift velocity that is associated with some function s. The gradient of this function gives you this mean drift velocity, something like that. And then there is, you know, there is the probability distribution, because this is a random process, so there's some probability distribution for where the particle is, it's evolving in time. Okay. And then what he does at the end of this, he defines a function psi, a complex function psi, given by this. And he shows that this obeys the Schrödinger equation. Okay. And it seems that you could generalize this to more particles by just doing this in configuration space. I have this funny evolution configuration space, and I get. Now, this theory has not been discussed in the literature anywhere near as much as the Broglie. The Broglie, we understand, at least in the non-relativistic theory, we understand very well how quantum measurements work and all this kind of stuff. This theory has not been studied anywhere near as much detail. In fact, a lot of people work on foundations. It seems they don't even know about this theory. Now, there is an objection to this theory that was raised by Wallström. Wallström, in 1995, in Phys Rev A, which says the following, let's see if I can get this straight, that is essentially this problem, that in this, in Nelson's theory, this function S is just some sort of globally defined function on this space, whether it's free space or configuration space. And yet we know, if you look at, let's say you look at the hydrogen atom, so the wave function for the electron in the hydrogen atom, if you're in, if you're in the first excited state, so let me put it this way, N is 2, L is 1, M is 1. Okay, it's got angular momentum. Okay? If you look at the wave function, it's a real thing times a term that is e to the I phi, where phi is the azimuthal angle around here. This is the z axis. So this is phi around here. And this function, there's a 1 over r, this thing diverges at the origin. Okay? So, hang on. It's 0. It's 0. There's an r. Okay? It vanishes at the origin. Okay? So there is a node. The z axis, that's wrong. It's not r. It's z. Let me just describe to you. All along the z axis, this function is 0. Okay? There's a node. And you have this phase going around. Now, Wallström says there's no way that a wave function like this is going to come out of Nelson's theory because the phase here is multivalued. As I go around the node, phi increases, and the phase, in the presence of nodes, the phase of a complex valued field is a multivalued function. So he claims that there is a problem with getting states of non-zero angular momentum. And I'm not completely sure that this objection is really kills the theory. I suspect it maybe it does. But there is this objection. Let's say nobody has written a decent reply to this yet. So it's sort of, it does, at first sight, it looks as if there is this theory, and it's a sort of stochastic, a bit like the Dreyer-Bohmer stochastic version, but it seems to have this problem. So we don't know, actually, if there is a theory other than the Dreyer-Bohmer. And what's particularly interesting about this is that if this theory is true, then it's an example of a theory in which the wave function is a sort of derived quantity. It doesn't exist ontologically, it's just sort of phenomenological. It would be nice to know if there exists such theories. It's not clear that the theory actually works. Apart from that, there's really nothing else. I mean, there are people write papers that claim there's some kind of hidden variables theory, but frankly, when you look at the details, theory doesn't really work, or at best, they haven't really thought it through to check that it really gives you quantum mechanics. So at the moment, we're sort of just left with Dreyer-Bohmer.
I think that should be the last question. Maybe we can use that afterwards. Thank you. So if you're, I mean, if you just hear Mark, don't hit them up. I'm not going to hand them out individually because I'm waiting for a meeting.